Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Archer Gray's PLM Quick 30, where we dive into all things PLM, digital thread, and digital transformation. Got to make sure we cover all those digital phrases here. I'm your host, Patrick Sullivan, and thank you for joining us today. If you've been struggling with how to build teams that succeed, you're in luck, because that's our topic of discussion today. I'm really excited for the conversation. We have a special guest today who has a tremendous career, starting off as a consultant at Accenture and moving into various VP and CIO positions for a number of companies, including Fortune 500. Her unique approach and trail of successes has led her to a path that's resulted in the creation of her own company, and I should say companies, that help people achieve an inclusive culture. Now, if that's a new term for you, then you're about to learn about it and how it can help you build a team that succeeds. So our guest today is Trish Tirizzo, who is the CEO and founder of Ascentia. In addition, she's the managing partner at Triple Hill Consulting, which is a management consulting company that offers advisory services for digital transformation. So Trish, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks, Patrick. Happy to be here.
Now, great. So I've given a brief introduction. So would you mind kind of filling in the gaps and telling a little bit more about your story?
Sure. So as you said, I started in consulting, which seems like a million years ago, but that was Anderson Consulting, which later became Accenture. That led to a career in, you know, big in process, business process, but also systems. And, you know, that was back in the day with the big ERP implementations, which was a new journey for so many companies. And so I just started out specializing there, leading those type of initiatives, having to build teams quickly, often to achieve those results, build teams, disassemble teams, rebuild teams. And then eventually I did move into left consulting, started working with one of my clients at the time. It was Boston Scientific, and took on a role there. And then, you know, that, you know, one thing led to another. But I would say one thing that's consistent across all the roles I've had as a CIO or head of IT in different companies was the need for speed, the need to build teams that were, you know, high performing, would achieve the results that the company really was keen on obtaining. And like I said, oftentimes in the world of IT, you're building teams and then you're disassembling teams and then building another team in somewhat of a pivot, and then same thing, disassembling. So have had a good time doing that and creating those teams for the companies.
Yeah, well, thanks for filling in some of that background. The idea of building and rebuilding, like it's fun to think about when you're watching your local team, whatever sport it is,
right?
You know, thinking about rebuilding. But when you're talking about a company and you've got these corporate initiatives that you're, you know, like you said, race against time,
right?
Sometimes the luxury of building a team, you know, I don't know. I mean, how do you approach those types of scenarios? And I guess if we rewind a little bit and just explore this life that you've laid out as a CIO, I mean, let's talk about justification for the programs, first of all, because like you said, the corporation has objectives that they want to achieve. And so how do you analyze and justify and prioritize these investments in the first place? And are you thinking about the dynamic of the team and whether or not you need to rebuild, or are you deciding what programs you're going to pursue first?
Yeah, that's a great question. The best way to go about this certainly is the IT leader is not building the investment plan. However, the IT leader is coordinating the efforts across the company to determine what should be on the investment roadmap for, you know, the 3 to 5 year technology roadmap. So, you know, I think it's our remit as leaders in technology to, through our partnerships, to sit down with our divisional presidents, our functional leaders, and review or ask, what's your strat map look like? What is your business strategy for finance or for division A or division B or supply chain or manufacturing? And, you know, it's our job to coordinate those discussions, understand what they're trying to achieve, and then for that, what technology enablers will be required for them to achieve those results. And then pull everybody together and say, okay, you know, in aggregate, this is what you're all driving. Our job is to look for those synergies across time. And then our job is also to have a point of view about how much can a company take on at any point in time in addition to its core operations. You know, so again, I see our role as coordinator of all of that, that results in that, you know, 3 to 5 year technology roadmap. In all of that, obviously that return, you know, so while we should not be in charge or accountable for the ROI of these initiatives, again, I think we champion and carry the torch and coordinate the efforts that drive what is the value of each investment. What's it going to bring back to the table to grow the top line or to reduce the OPEX? And then our job, again, I think, is to organize and facilitate a, you know, rank order of that. So what are we going to take on this year as a company? And, you know, usually creating a committee that at a minimum has the CEO and the CFO at the table of, okay, here's all the great stuff the entire company wants to do. Here's what value each of these are going to bring, either top line or reducing OPEX. And, you know, and then we, you know, from there, that committee drives what will and will not be done in any given year.
Are there, how frequent is it that either a particular division or, you know, the screechy wheel gets the grease,
yeah, right?
Right. Versus what's best for, you know, what you described is that, you know, ideally there's a governance methodology in place and right. There's a decision-making process that's fluid. Is it always that well designed or is it often, are there some curveballs in there?
I think many companies struggle with this, right? There's, you know, it's either the, you know, hey, who got to the line first with an idea and then off that goes, right? It's not, there's not many companies out there that have that rigor in place. There are some, but many that I've worked with have needed this to be installed. And, you know, I would say what you see a lot of companies do is their annual planning. And then, you know, and then who's got money to do something or who's first in or the ideas, you know, ideas first there rather than that really, really what I call value-based operations. What's going to bring the greatest value to the entire company? And that means different things for different companies. In a particular year, maybe greatest value is reducing OPEX because there's maybe a lot of cost pressure for a company. Maybe for another company, that value, the greatest value is growing top line. And I think devising, it's also our job to devise kind of that, you know, how are we going, what weight are we going to give to each of those? You know, what weight are we going to give to reducing risk? What weight are we going to give to growing top line? What weight are we going to give to reducing OPEX so that we can judge, you know, fairly all the investments that are coming in terms of the agility? If that's done, you know, if it's done annually, that's still good, but obviously the world doesn't work on an annual calendar, right? Right. Stuff happens every day. And, you know, so you lay the plan out, but, you know, a week after you lay the plan, something's happened. The company decided they're going to acquire another company or they're announcing an acquisition or they're divesting something or they're restructuring, right? There's always something to disrupt the best laid plan. And having, you know, not just the governance model in place of what you're going to do annually, but also a process to take in anything additional, these, you know, like a walk-on type of initiative, and weigh that against other things that are out there? And are we just going to add it to? And what does that do to us, not just on the delivery side, what does it do to us operationally? Will we have enough people in the different business functions to take all of this on and run the business? And kind of, you know, looking through that, again, it's our role to paint that picture so that decision makers can make a, you know, a thoughtful decision.
When you are, you know, my interpretation of what you said was that it's a, there's objectives that people want to achieve. You look at the systems and the processes associated to it and decide what the value, how you're going to judge success from a value perspective, right? And you're a facilitator of that. When do you start to pay attention to the people side of things? Is that incorporated in those first two, or do you build the roadmap first and you say, we can take these on because we've got good teams and these, like, is that part of the ranking system?
Yeah, and that's a great question. So yeah, let's, you know, when you're taking on what's of highest value, you know, and then you're going to paint a picture. So you all agree what's of highest value, what are the weighting of these different categories? And you could then start painting out, what does that multi-year roadmap look like? And what does it look like in year one? You know, a good approach is to lay that out, load it as if you, I don't want to say have infinite resources, but, you know, responsibly lay out what you believe would be feasible, but don't over constrain yourself. Because again, if you're trying to, you know, a lot of companies, I think, end up stifling growth, right? Without, you know, thinking about how can they creatively get a lot of work done that might exceed their own capacity. So, you know, a good approach is lay these things out. Again, there's got to be, you know, somewhat about feasibility considered in there. And then really think creatively about how you would go about getting this done, what people, what resources it would take out of the organization. Obviously, you know, IT is rarely the limiting factor. It's, will you have enough people in finance, or will you have enough people in manufacturing, or in sales of Division One? And loading at an aggregate level, I call it an aggregate, right, roadmap of initiatives, loading in the resources below and understanding, is it feasible? And where it's not, where do you get locked up? See what you can adjust at the aggregate level of when you would start an initiative. You know, sliding something just 1 month to the right might unlock an issue, and, you know, working it there. And then again, you know, think creatively. You know, I think another lever, and then add the cost to the program, is backfilling resources in a company. You know, oftentimes that's thought about too late. Because people say, well, you know, it's going to take 3 months for somebody to get up to speed, and then, you know, be useful to get in the position to be able to pull the guy out who's doing that job today to go on a project. But if you knew about that 6 months before you start the project, it shouldn't be a limiting factor. So think about backfill opportunities to be able to get this work done, so that you bake it into the cost of the program and you have plenty of lead time to make that work.
That's sound advice right there. A lot of, you know, there's an art to planning, and that's into estimating, and everybody in an organization has to estimate and plan at some point. And then it really takes experience and probably overcoming some challenges throughout your career to be able to talk about that and say, hey, listen, sliding it one way, either back or forth, could alleviate the problem. Always incorporate backfill into, you know, your plan of what if XYZ happens. I mean, it's a little difficult from our perspective, because we'll tell our clients, we'll say, listen, we know that you're experienced at this, but you should bake in, we recommend 30%. We understand that may be tough for you to get, but 30% to accommodate potential shifts in schedule or things that pop up that you don't anticipate, but you will be able to accommodate because you plan for it.
Right.
It's a tough conversation.
Yeah. It is. And, you know, and I think our role is illustrating that, right? You know, picture speaks a thousand words, as they say, you know, like illustrating, you know, what this, you know, multiple investments under one timeline and then the resource requirements for that and how to solve it, right? Moving these pieces around and how to solve and then where you really get jammed up, where there's no choice but the backfill.
Yeah.
You know, being able to illustrate that again to executives and people that need to make a decision, it's our job to make that crystal clear so it's easy to understand and simple. You know, oftentimes I think companies struggle because they're running projects in silos and it's hard for them to see the cumulative effect of that on the organization. And, you know, illustrating that cumulative effect, but not after the fact, right? What that cumulative effect has in 6 months or in 9 months or 12 and 18 months allows for this type of planning and incorporating those costs into programs.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. If you don't mind, I kind of want to jump onto this people side of things around building teams, right? So what are some of your, so you've got your plan laid out and now we're talking about the people aspect of this and we've anticipated some type of backfill scenarios. What are some of your key strategies when you're building a team to pursue these programs?
Yeah. Earlier on when you had asked to kind of give a little bit about myself, I used the word assemble and disassemble, assemble and disassemble. I think, you know, for anybody out there that's, you know, running a portfolio of programs or projects or initiatives, you know, thinking really nimbly about people and the kind of role that they can fill on different initiatives is critical. At the same time, we don't want to be, you know, at the same time, spreading people across multiple initiatives can create a lot of a retooling burden that will consume a significant portion of a person's capacity. So if you have one person on 10 initiatives, you know, and they're on Monday, they're working on two, and on Tuesday, they're working on two, they will tell you themselves, they spend time emotionally retooling to get out of one thing and back into another that, you know, at the end of the week, they've spent 25% of their time retooling to move between a number of initiatives. So, you know, I think being thoughtful about how we plan resources across different initiatives so you don't have a retooling burden, I think, you know, is one, I'll call it guiding principle I always think about. Another guiding principle is, you know, understanding what a team needs to be at the start of a program and not being afraid to imagine what a team needs to be at a different phase in the program. And, you know, for some really larger IT transformational initiatives, you might start out with a certain structure, operating structure for a team. And oftentimes there comes a point where you have to pivot and change that structure of the team to get from, you know, from the beginning that might have been requirements through, you know, through design, through development. You might get into testing, you need to now pivot the team in a different form with different leaders running different stacks of work to get from testing out to deploy. And, you know, so again, another guiding principle is don't feel that the team you put in place and the structure of the team you put in place at the beginning needs or should be the structure at the end. So operating model.
How do you handle the potential communication factor of that? Because the people, you know, the intent of the design or the intent of the requirements and that traceability associated to that, who's carrying that torch if the team is shifting from one major phase to, for instance, the testing phase?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not that you're taking every people off the team and putting them on another team and bringing in new characters. It's the structure of the team that you've put in and who's leading stacks or work streams. and what their role is at the earlier phase, and then what it becomes in later phase, and maybe making a pivot of who's leading testing. Like somebody who's leading maybe a phase of, you know, the requirements phase for design might not be the best suited person to lead a testing phase. So again, you know, don't feel like you have to stay locked in with certain leadership positions, and nothing here should ever change the artifacts that we're talking about, right? You know, traceability matrix of your artifacts from requirements all the way through design and develop and test.
So, you know, going back to why you started Ascentia, right? Mm-hmm. I want to bring up the topic of, and I don't know if this is a sensitive topic, so we can steer clear, but gender and building teams and some of the other points associated to it. Is it important, the balance of it? And if so, why?
Right. So, you know, it's really, you know, Patrick, this has been, it's been a journey for, I think, all of us. And when we think about what life was like, I don't know, 20 years ago, and you think about all the journals and the articles that we read, and, you know, whether it's Harvard Business Review or any of the others. And back then we were told, if you're diverse, you're going to win. You're going to have a winning team. You're going to beat out competition. We were just told it was about diversity. So we blindly ran out there and, well, I need to be diverse. Look, I'm an IT department. I got all males on my team. I need to shake it up. Let's get, to your point, gender. Let's get some women in here. Let's get people of color in here. Just because we were told diversity wins. And so why, you know, why were we told that? Well, lots of good reasons, right? Diverse thinking. It's not just about gender, but it's about, I mean, you know, the idea of gender, if you're out there developing a product and you, the people developing the product don't represent the people who are going to purchase the product, are you really going to develop the best product for the people, for your consumers, right? So there's all kinds of different, you know, scenarios that say diversity brings greater, you know, robust thinking, well-rounded thinking about what we're developing, how we develop it. Diversity, you know, comes in many different forms, not just gender and race. And, you know, it's also how long in career. So somebody new, fresh in, you know, industry might bring new perspectives to some of us who've been in it for 20 or 30 years. So, I think everybody agrees there's value to diversity, but we blindly jumped in just saying, all right, great. Let's go get some young people. let's get women on the team. Let's get people of color on the team. But what was what now everybody's recognizing. So, you know, those two letters at the end of DE&I, the E and I, we really probably had it backwards. We were driving for diversity, but we didn't have inclusive cultures and environments. And so, you know, when building these teams, one thing to think about, aside from the practical terms of what it takes to deliver and how you structure a team from an operating model, but if you do want that diversity, you have to ensure that you've got an inclusive culture first. And that's, I think that's where, that's a journey many companies are making. And, you know, I say journey because it's, there's a lot to this subject. That's part of what we do at Ascentia. We partner with companies to really take that journey to create an inclusive culture so that they can achieve their diversity objectives.
So can you, you know, that term may be new to some folks listening. So inclusive culture, can you please expand on it and give some examples around it?
Sure. You know, essentially, it's really simple. Does everybody feel welcomed? Do they feel valued? Do they feel like they belong? Do they, you know, feel like they're part of the team? You know, the word, you know, those word belonging, valued, welcomed, and then the word feeling around that, that, you know, that's all individual. And the way, you know, the way I like to explain it for somebody, you know, there's an easy way to think about it. Think of a zebra in a herd of elephants, right? The herd of elephants will often, and individuals in the herd, when you're part of the gang, right, or part of the herd, you act in a certain way that sometimes without even knowing what you're doing, you know, things that you're saying or not saying, things that you're doing or not doing, things that you're even thinking or not thinking, create and send a message to the zebra that you're not welcomed here. And there are little subtle things. What makes this really hard, Patrick, for everybody is that there are things that first, the person in the herd doesn't even know they're doing it because it's kind of hardwired behavior. And nobody else sees it. And the only person who sees it or feels it is the zebra. And so it's really a tough one to get your arms around, right? And that's what this journey is really about for many companies, is understanding what are those things that are invisible to us, and how do we create awareness so that we can recognize those? How can we tune in so that we don't make these mistakes, and we don't send the message to people, you're not welcomed, you don't belong, you shouldn't be here, you're not valued.
Is there an example that you can think of that would help? I like the analogy, and maybe this is deeper than you want to go, but...
Well, that's okay.
Yeah. Is there an example that you can share with us?
Yeah, exactly. And it's something really, you know, for your listeners, right? Particularly, you know, I'm assuming many are in some kind of technology, right? Engineering or R&D or IT. You know, we've all struggled with it, right? Myself as a leader, I've always leaned on HR. I'm like, bring more women, bring more people of color. Like, where are they? And, you know, and then we'd hire some and we'd be high-fiving each other. Like, yeah, we get some in. And then people are resigning, right? The zebras are resigning. And I could never get my organizations, you know, above a certain number, like above 15% women in IT, or, you know, it's always a challenge. And, you know, so examples of things. And, you know, again, I want to say to your listeners, these things that we do, that people in the herd do, don't even know that they're doing it. Because I don't want to send anybody, like put anybody off, like here, you should go feel guilty because you shouldn't. These things that we do are hardwired into us from the time we're in the cradle, and we're socialized, and they're firmed up through socialization as we grow and move through life. So I want to put that out there before I give any examples. So people are like, oh, that's, you know, you call me the bad guy over here. We're not bad guys, but really everybody is socialized in this way. So some examples that you hear people often share that happens to them. One example is when you're the zebra, it takes just a few minutes in a meeting, a handful of minutes, for the herd, people in the herd, to just completely stop making eye contact with you in a meeting. And you could be sitting in the chair and you notice, like if you're the zebra, you notice like, wait a minute, nobody's even looking at me. Like there's no eye contact. Like the people start talking around the room and they literally like jump over across around you as they're engaging with each other. And you can imagine what that would feel like, right? Like if you're the zebra, you're like, why is nobody talking to me? Why is nobody, you know, like, it just feels bad. You're like, it feels like, I always tell people, if that's hard for you to imagine, because it's never happened, you've probably not been the zebra in a corporate environment. Mm-hmm. But maybe you could think back to a time when you were a kid and like, I don't know, like you weren't part of the cool kid. Like, what did it feel like when like the people weren't engaging you,
right?
Or in a sport or something like that? What did it feel like? Because these type of things happen in a corporate environment often, and they send messages to certain groups or individuals of you know, underrepresented groups in a company that they're not welcome. So that's one example.
Yeah, that's a really good example. And it's a soft one, just like you said. It's hardwired into how you may not even notice that it's happening because you're so comfortable within the group that you don't see the folks that may not have the same comfort level. It's tough to have awareness of that if you've never been taught to be aware of it.
Right. You know, oftentimes another one, I call it the spin the bottle. and again, this is what people have told me, right? That happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes women will tell you that when, you know, and they could even be more senior than other people in a room. And let's say, I don't know, there's 8 people and 1 woman, and somebody will come in and they'll start asking the question. And of course your viewers can't see me now, but like somebody who asked the question, you know, a guy maybe will come in and say, "So has anybody here ordered lunch for today?" And the word today, it'll always land on the female, like the question mark lands. That's why I call it spin the bottle. Yeah. Like when it comes to the question mark, it lands to the one female in the room. And then everybody looks at her like, "So did you order lunch?" And it could be like the SVP of whatever in the room. And there's just an assumption that oftentimes the same spin the bottle happens with who's going to take the notes or who's going to take meeting minutes, right? You know, some of these administrative type things, it's just assumed that if there's a woman in the room, like the herd just assumes that's the person who should do it.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's very subtle.
I mean, yeah, it is. It's very subtle. And like I said, the only person who notices is like, so, and then here's something else that happens and why at Essentia, we want to have these dialogues with companies that want they really want to tune into this because they don't want to send those messages. We work with them to, you know, go through these type of examples and understand what this is, what it looks like, how to recognize it, and then what kind of culture do you want to build? How do you start the journey to correct on that? And you know, while we have that conversation, I like to share, hey, it's not, while it's important, right? Now, so when we talk about why is inclusivity important, because we talk about diversity, but why is inclusivity important? Well, you just simply want everybody to feel welcomed and to contribute. You've gone out of your way to hire people into your organization, but if they feel like they're not valued or welcomed or what it is, you can imagine how they'll start not contributing, not participating, and start looking for a job or just be disengaged, right? And so that's one way to think about it, is your employees and just wanting them to feel good, but also wanting them to contribute because you brought them into the organization to be part of it. And something else to think about, though, is if this is happening with your employees, you know, there's likely commercial losses you're experiencing and don't even know. So if you have, I can give a number of examples of personal examples of where things were said or done, where somebody was trying to sell me as a CIO something. And it was just so, you know, what should I say? I don't even know how to label it, but it was a big misstep on a salesperson's part to say something that they didn't even realize. And for me, I could be like, well, that's fine. I'll award them this $100 million work. Or I've got 4 other people who are bidding on it anyway. Why would I go with this person?
Yeah.
You know, and sharing some of those examples with companies about, okay, it's about how engaged are your employees, but also are there commercial losses you're experiencing and you're not even aware of it?
I mean, some of this is just like, you know, tripping my mind a little bit, but let me see if I can reverse that statement around commercialization, right? Because oftentimes when people are, and we talked about it at the beginning of this conversation about ROI and unlocking value and laying out a roadmap, and we're talking about technology, process primarily, and then we started to dive into this people thing. And the people planning aspect of it typically stops at capacity and expertise, right?
Right.
and that's the planning. And now what we're talking about is this whole other feeling of engagement and that trickle-on effect of whether or not they feel inclusive, which is going to create a better team, a better result. So if we take your last comment and we're talking about the potential consequences, like the potentially negative side of not paying attention to inclusivity, mm-hmm. if you reflect on your career, can you speak to any impact of your strategies where you've successfully, you know, made progress on inclusivity and on the past programs and the benefit from pursuing that strategy?
Yeah. You know, I'll be honest, Patrick, this is a journey for so many people. I think, you know, I can think of a couple of times where I've had an opportunity to come in and rethink an organization. What should the operating model be for a company? And, you know, kind of like a zero-based budgeting, zero-based operating model design and requisite organization to support that design, you know, building that organization out. So I've been able to do that a couple of times. And in doing that, you know, kind of holding the line on saying, look, it might take five times longer to fill a role with a diverse candidate than to fill it with any candidate. Or the general, right? The, you know, general people who would normally fill that. And holding out was painful because as a leader, until you fill those positions, you are filling those positions, right? Yeah. Somebody's got to do the work, right? There was one company, I felt like I was in six boxes, right? And you're trying to hold up the teams, right? You've got these critical positions that are open. Filling those positions with diverse candidates helped and drawing a line saying, look, I've got a leadership team. There's going to be eight senior vice presidents. I think, you know, half we should fill with diverse candidates so that they can then drive and give them the same remit, them and all senior leaders, the remit that they should be driving that diversity through. And again, I'll say this. For me back then, it was all about the diversity first, and we weren't looking at that inclusivity. And I can say that we felt the impact, but didn't know why. And, you know, this idea of putting the I first and making that the priority, I don't want to say it's new for many because we've always talked about it, the importance of it. And the critical importance and how it's actually a dependency to the diversity is where many of us are. So in the past, I thought I was doing the right thing because I was taking care of the D, but not really understanding what was happening on the floor of my departments, what was happening in the meetings, and were these type of things happening, yes or no, and really addressing that. I was like many other people struggling to kind of, you know, bring in diverse candidates and retain diverse candidates because of what was happening that I couldn't see around inclusivity. So, it's the work I'm doing now to help companies get there. But again, it's a newer space for many people.
I mean, it's really an epiphany. Quite frankly, because there's the recognition that it's happening, right? And so you try to deal with the culture to raise awareness and then mentor, train. I mean, it's a feeling thing. So it's not like you can go into training.
That's exactly right. It's a two, you know, so the model that we put in place for Ascentia is look, there, you know, this stuff that happens, right? You know, there's a zebra and a herd. Does it impact every zebra out there? No, there's plenty of women in male-dominated fields that have risen to the top. And there's plenty of, you know, pick the zebra in whatever herd, right? But that's not everybody. It's not the majority. Many people don't know how to manage those situations. So the idea with the Ascentia model is that we coach individuals. So, you know, and for us, you know, our model is, it's not exclusively to, but it is specifically to women in male-dominated fields, coaching them as individuals to develop the right tactics to thrive in those environments, not survive, but to thrive in those environments, use those points, those things that happen as levers and leverage to drive your success, because there's ways to do it. At the same time, coach the company and their culture to become aware of that, because neither one of these things are going to happen overnight. And, you know, and by doing both, we think we'll, and so when we think of our ideal client, we think of a company that's keen on changing the culture and keen on supporting the development of women in their organization.
Yeah. I mean, as you're talking, like, just simply communication is the starting point and the consistent, like, North Star, right? There's empowerment of somebody who feels like the zebra, but if you feel like the zebra, it doesn't mean that you have to necessarily retract, but they may not know how to communicate. They may not know the tools. They may not know the psychological impact of, oh, well, I don't want to be combative. When really, if everybody's ready to have the conversation and willing to listen and willing to analyze themselves and express themselves in a real way, in a welcoming way, even if you disagree, like, we can still be colleagues and respect each other and thrive.
Yeah, Patrick, that's right. You know, some of the, I mean, there's tactics that we share with women that are not even about directly addressing it. I mean, you can change the dynamic of a room very easily and subtly yourself. And what we teach women is, hey, look, what just happened? Look, first off, if you're just entering corporate, here's stuff that's going to happen. Like, it's just going to happen. Be ready for it. And when it does, here's what you should do. And so we share that with them. And most importantly, share, and it's going to happen not because you're not valued, not because people think you don't belong. It's going to happen because people are wired in a certain way. And it plays out in this way. So a big part of that is coaching that it's not you. And having, you know, coaching that, you know, before they walk into that, and, you know, it goes a long way on, you know, from a confidence perspective, like, okay, it's not me. This is a normal thing. This is what happens. So that's an important thing. And then working with companies to say every company has a culture that's unique to them. What is it, you know, what is their, you know, are they running by tribe? Are they running by consensus? You know, like what kind of, and working with them to say, what kind of a culture do we want to create around this? Do we want to be the kind of, you know, call it in the room when you see it? Or do we want to be the kind to have, you know, like a debrief later? Hey, I noticed whatever. But, you know, again, designing that with the company, so it's customized to fit into who they are, is really important as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I certainly love the evolution of your journey. And we spoke a little bit before this conversation, you know, the podcast started recording about, it's funny, we're all doing these technical process related things where we're accomplishing things on a list. And oftentimes on a piece of paper, unless you're a poet, you're missing the emotional side of things. And right. I love that your journey's brought you to this emotional side of things and the sense of a community and how powerful a community can be. So to that point, what type of results do your clients expect when they engage with you from the Essentia side?
Yeah. In terms of companies, right, from an inclusivity perspective and an awareness program, I think there's a realistic expectation that they're just beginning a journey that's going to take a while. I've not met anybody who's like, okay, so, you know, how do we fix this by November? Right. I've got one client who has said, you know, like, it was, you know, something to the nature of, you know, it took us 40 years to get here. We're not going to get out of here in a month or, you know, in a short amount of time. And, you know, and when some of the things that we're talking about, when we say how long it took us to get here, right? When we think about society, when we think about how we operate and how we've been trained to think and how our brains are wired and work, it's been a lot longer than 40 years, right? This has been going on for a long time. So I'd say there's realistic expectations that this is a journey we're starting. I think there is, though, at the same time, an expectation like, can you tell us what we should and should not do? What's the, like, is there a decoder ring here? Is there like a template? Yeah. Can you give me the directions? Right. And that's always a tough one because it's not that simple. You know, it's not, we don't want people walking around in a company on eggshells, and we don't want to say, never use this word, never say that, never say this, because, you know, so much of this is around judgment and good judgment. But, you know, to apply good judgment, you need to be aware of what these things are. You know, the couple of examples that we talk about here, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of things that occur that send messages to a zebra: you don't belong here, you shouldn't be here, leave now. And, you know, sharing what those are in a safe place so that people don't feel guarded, they understand it is the way it is, but let's learn about it. Like, let's find our awakening around this so that we're aware of it, we're cognizant of it, and then we can begin the journey.
Yeah, that's, you know, the comment that you made around being hardwired. I'm doing a self-analysis of some of the scenarios that you are bringing up. I'm like, how am I hardwired? It take a lot of discovery, you know, even on just one topic for myself. So right. I just love the work that you're doing, and I love the topic. I think it's not only fascinating, but essential for us to continue to evolve on this journey of not just from a society perspective, but, you know, where are you going to start? And I love that Essentia focuses on the individual that may feel like the zebra, to give them tools of empowerment to be able to communicate effectively and not necessarily take this offensive approach, but arm them with ways of dealing with it when it happens and recognizing it. It's something that exists that we need to deal with, and you're taking a positive approach to it. So I really love that you were willing to sit down with me on this podcast, share some of these thoughts, share your vision and your passion around it. I know one last question, because I know people are listening in management positions, executive positions. What advice would you give to them, going back to the beginning, while they're developing and thinking strategically about these programs that they're looking to pursue and succeed that's tied to value and ROI? I mean, given this whole people conversation, I'm sure it's a topic that would be new to them in their planning to be successful. What advice do you have for them to build successful teams so they achieve what they're looking to achieve?
Yeah. You know, this will sound like a big step deviation, you know, step off of the, you know, inclusivity conversation we've just been having. You know, this is going to sound so Captain Obvious, but I can't tell you how many times I see in companies, this happening, I'm sure your listeners have as well, that you've got a really important initiative, you know, really important investment. Great. You've rank ordered your stuff. Everybody said, this is the most, here's our three, you know, our strategic imperatives that we need to deliver on. And then we go and we say, okay, who's going to lead this thing? And we say, well, let's get that guy. He's really well organized, or that person, you know, they're really well organized and they really want a new challenge. And we give it to them, but they don't have the experience to deliver that kind of thing. And you know, oftentimes, you know, I would say, you know, these critical roles, these critical delivery roles, you know, finding somebody who's not just a clipboard carrying task manager, did you do your job, did you do your job, but somebody who truly is a delivery leader who understands all, because they were in all aspects of delivery at a point in their career, that you're picking the right person, you know, regardless of what, you know, what their gender, whatever, you're picking somebody who really has the experience to be successful. And if you don't have somebody, you know, add the dollars, add the money into your program if you can, and do it early, and bring somebody in who can partner with them so that they can learn that. But having them, you know, try to do this because they've got maybe some leverageable skills from something else. I mean, it's you know, oftentimes setting individuals up for failure, and then having to worry about how to correct a program later or drive a recovery effort.
Yeah, and then you're dealing with the backfill issue.
Yeah, exactly.
With multiples attached to it.
Exactly. So, you know, it's all about the right skill and the right seat, which I know is sometimes a lot easier said than done, but it's, you know, critical to success, obviously.
Yeah. Well, Trish, I've really enjoyed the experience of being witness to all of your culminated success and the advice and where the journey's brought you. I really appreciate you dealing with some of these difficult questions. I know they're not topics that are normally covered, you know, related to PLM projects specifically, right. But I think it's essential for everybody to pay attention to this topic, have these conversations. And I really, you know, appreciate your insight. So thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening to this episode. If you want more information on Archer Gray or more information related to the great work that Trish is doing, go to Ascentia.com. You will see the transcript on our website. And if you need any additional information from Archer Gray, please feel free to email us at info@archergray.com. And Trish, I assume going to your website is the best way to get in touch with you, either Triple
it
Hill
is.
Consulting. Or...
Yeah, or Ascentia.com or Triple Hill Consulting. Yeah.
All right. Great. Well, thanks and have a great day.
Thanks so much. You too, Patrick.